It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Matthew Ingram and Kevin C. Toefel are here filling in for Jeff Jarvis and Stacey Higginbotham. We have a lot to talk about, including Article 11 and 13 now passed through the European Parliament. It's going to be up to the individual European nations to make it law. What will that mean for the Internet next?
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 501, recorded Wednesday, March 27th, 2019. I didn't say it, Oprah did. This Week in Google is brought to you by Capterra. Find the right tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Visit Capterra's free website at capterra.com/twig. It's time for Twig, This Week in Google, the show where we talk about the latest news from the Googleverse, which these days is includes Facebook and Twitter and journalism. Matthew Ingram's here back from Italy, or are you about to go to Italy?
Just about to go.
I'm so jealous. This is the big news event every year in, where is it?
Perugia,
that's
Perugia.
Right.
Perugia. Mm-hmm.
And Jeff's going too, I think. So that'll be fun. Jeff isn't here today. He's traveling. Matthew is, of course, chief digital writer at the Columbia Journalism Review, longtime Giga-omer and Fortuner. He's been around, and he's been in on our shows many times. We always love having him on. And Stacey's not here either, but she set in her place a fine cockapoo named Norman. And along with Norman comes Kevin Toefel.
He's already sacked out on
is
my
Is he a cockapoo? IQ. I just made that up. I don't know.
A Bichon Frise, which is French for Borg.
I had a Bichon Frise.
Yeah.
A
great dog.
Yeah.
Great dog.
I should have read, I mentioned this before, but I should have, I don't know if I said it to you, in the description of Bichon on the Kennel Club site, it says they make excellent circus dogs. Mm. And I should have read between the lines what that meant. Now, your Norm is very calm, but our Bichon was not.
When the camera is on, Norm is very calm. Normally, a couple times a day, he'll just go wild and run around the house and like a madman, like a cheetah, really fast. And
we loved our Bichon. He was great, but the kids were
I do that too sometimes.
Yeah, right.
I remember from when I worked with you. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, there goes Matthew again. Give him a bone.
I forgot, Leo. I meant to have my lower third updated.
It's not about Chromebooks.com anymore?
No, it is. It is. I'm on temporary assignment as a former TV Guide critic this week.
Mocking poor Jeff Jarvis's lower third on MSNBC the last time he was on. Of all the things you could say about Jeff Jarvis, nice. Former TV Guide critic is absolutely the most demeaning. Nothing lower. Nothing lower. Holy cow.
Yeah.
So I think there's a very big story of Bruin. It isn't imminent, but it is a Bruin. The European Parliament yesterday passed the new copyright bill, and that means they passed Articles 11 and 13 unchanged. And this is a big freaking deal. Now, it's not law because each country has to then endorse it, and they can change it. It's very likely that we'll see France endorse it first, since really it was France that pushed this new copyright law.
And just to confuse everything, they've changed Article 13. It's Article 17.
Yeah. Oh, that's – oh, never mind. No problem. This despite millions of petitions, signatures, phone calls, letters, complaints from the big internet companies and regular internet users. What is, so first of all, this is a general copyright bill. It's called Copyright in the Digital Single Market Directive, whatever that is. And it's not a directive. It's a directive, not a law. Mm-hmm. So because it's a directive, the EU nations now have 2 years to do something called transpose it, which is make it their own law, written into their law, and possibly modified for that country. So countries have until 2021 now. France will almost certainly jump on this.
So, and I think that's actually part of the problem, is that we don't know how lots of these countries are going to interpret this somewhat vague descriptions of the things that the EU agreed to. And so you could actually wind up with this incredibly sort of balkanized process where if you do something in, you know, Denmark, it's okay. But if you do exactly the same thing in France, it's not okay.
Which one of you would like to, why don't you take this, Matthew? Tell us what Articles 11 and now 17 say and what it means.
So 11, without going into too much detail, 11 is about upload filters. I'm pretty sure I have that right. So is 11 the link tax? Okay. So 11 is, broadly speaking, gives content owners the right to charge aggregators for excerpts of their content.
So this is so aimed at Google, because Google puts, it's the snippet tax. Google puts little snippets in its search results. Google News has larger chunks. Google's already said, if this is the law of the land in Europe, then we will no longer be able to do Google News. They even showed a little extremely a picture of what search results would look like in Europe after this. But what we wouldn't see anymore is snippets. This is, by the way, not something, this is something that's been tried. Spain did it and Germany did it, both with very little success.
And Google pulled out of Spain completely.
Yeah.
There is no Spanish Google News.
Right. So that's 11. So that's the snippet tax.
Yeah. And one of the things that's vague about it is it says that
there's
you can
the page,
charge
by
for,
the way, that Google says, this is what the internet is going to look like.
No excerpts. Yeah. It looks like the page failed to load.
Yeah.
Which was obviously partly a PR effort. Look how terrible things
completely
look.
But if you did search for a story, you would just get Daily Star and a link, and you wouldn't know anything about the headline or anything, because those are all snippets.
And one of the things that's...
Matthew, you may not know. I'm just curious. What has this done in Spain, for example, to those publishers and their traffic?
It's killed traffic.
So it has reduced traffic, but not by as much as
you
might think.
Oh,
yeah. So it has, definitely. I think the last estimate I saw, there was a study done. It was in the neighborhood of 15% to 20%, which is still
that's not bad.
Serious.
I mean, that's,
it's not, but it's still significantly, you know, changed those businesses. And Germany, I think, when they, Axel Springer, removed itself effectively from Google News. And I think it said that it saw traffic declines of like 60%. So one of the things that makes this particular article difficult is it just says that publishers, content owners can charge for excerpts that aggregators like Google are allowed to use short excerpts. It doesn't say how short.
Oh boy.
It doesn't say a number of words.
Oh
it
boy.
Doesn't. So this is all going to be open to interpretation.
Right.
Is it 10 words? Is it 100 words? Is it 800
characters?
Words? Yeah.
Well, and the worst, it might be different in each country.
Exactly. So then the second one, 13, which is now 17, is the effectively makes any tech platform like Google or Facebook or Twitter responsible for the content that gets uploaded. And it is, those companies are required to remove copyrighted content before it gets uploaded to prevent it from being uploaded.
That's, to me, much more significant.
It's potentially, the ramifications are huge.
So now, for instance, when we upload something to YouTube that has material in it that a copyright holder disputes, there's a takedown process using the Digital Money and Copyright Act. But there's also a defense for us, the fair use defense, that we're a news organization. Apple, for instance, took down the YouTube video of our coverage of Apple's event on Monday. They also did a takedown on iOS Today, which we showed a small little snippet of one of the movie clips or something, like less than a minute. In both cases, we'll dispute it and say, no, it's fair use. This is commentary on a news story. We're a news organization. And YouTube will say, oh, yeah, never mind, and bring it back up after some period of time. And so there's a week or two that you're down, that you lose that revenue. That's the process today.
Right.
And under Article 230. Under Article, yeah, Section 230 allows fair use.
And it also protects the platforms from any liability.
That's important.
Right.
They get a safe harbor exemption. They can't be punished.
Right. And all they have to do is sort of make a good faith attempt to take content down when someone complains. So the EU directive would completely reverse that. So there is no protection, A, for anything that's uploaded.
There's no fair use exemption.
The onus is on the companies to prevent it, sort of prior restraint, if you want to think of it that way, to stop stuff from being uploaded. So the risk is they'll just stop everything,
right,
or at least huge quantities of stuff that arguably is, you know, fair use or fair dealing, as it's called in the UK and Australia and Canada.
I think Google's moving closer to this anyway with YouTube because our takedowns happen much faster, and I'm guessing that they're tuning up Content ID to do it on submission as opposed to on posting, right? That as soon as you submit something, content, they'll have to with this Article 17.
It's the only way to do it.
Yeah. Which means our stuff will get turned down before it is even aired.
They actually, it would not surprise me if you're right, Leo. Just, I missed your episode on the Stadia news last week. But if you recall, using the Google Assistant button on that, when you're playing a streaming game on Google, on Stadia, it knows where you are and brings up a YouTube video at that specific spot in the game if you need help.
Right.
So they're already, the technology is in some ways already right there.
Yeah, I'm sure Google's been thinking about this and planning for it. This seemed inevitable. And they had it, you know, an experience of it, the snippet tax in Germany and Spain. That's that Leitungsdirekt that Jarvis keeps talking about.
There's also been a huge amount of pressure on them in both Germany and France to remove hate speech and basically illegal speech.
Right.
So they've been gearing up to do that because there are massive fines involved if they don't take down sort of speech that breaches the rules within 24 hours.
I'm concerned, and I mean, obviously, there's lots of concern about this article, new Article 17/13. But I feel like something like what we do, which is commentary on news, and almost always the commentary on news is on somebody else's copyright story, would be jeopardized by something like this.
So the EU has said that there were a number of complaints, obviously, one being the upload filter was going to stop lots of stuff that was not copyright infringement, that it would stop people from, say, uploading memes and so on that use copyrighted content, but as a form of commentary. So the EU has said, that's not the case. That's not what we want to do. GIFs will be and memes will be protected, journalistic but and academic.
I got to point out, they're not protected.
Well, and they're not the ones who are going to be implementing
right.
it. They're just saying this is our principle.
Yeah, we don't want to punish memes.
Exactly.
But it's not, but if you don't want to punish memes, you put it in the law. Otherwise, right. it's the interpretation of the countries in the courts.
Right. And that's the risk, is that each of these countries are going to interpret it, you know, in some cases, in the most draconian way possible.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So is this really all about revenues for these publications, I guess I should say? I'm trying to look at it from my perspective as a publisher. All three of us on the show are publishers, obviously. I don't have like a, you know, subscription fees and things like that. I have my commentary out for free on the web. You know, it's ad supported, obviously, but I'm trying to figure out, I get the memes.
I don't
and
think
all
they even mentioned commercial versus non-commercial.
Yeah, see, that's an interesting aspect to me because I understand a publication that wants to, you know, preserve its revenues and so on. But we know that's been declining for years. And I'm just this nobody sitting in my, you know, house with my dog blogging. And I actually like having news snippets in Google News. It brings me traffic, obviously. So I'm just trying to figure out where I fit in and how this all is going to work.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, obviously this goes back decades or a decade in some cases. The feeling on the part of European publishers that Google in particular has been stealing content from them, stealing revenue from them. They've been putting pressure on the company, you know, for God knows how long. And it's led effectively to these kinds of restrictions. I'm not convinced that they're even going to help, that they're even going to sort of accomplish what these publishers and copyright holders theoretically want.
So we'll just watch with interest. I mean, I don't know. There's hope in one respect because there's still time to lobby individual countries. Although there was a lot of lobbying over the weekend, 200,000 people took to the streets across Europe. There are 5 million signatures on a petition, and the parliament quickly passed the resolution, the directive anyway. So I don't know what kind of hope we're going to have, but I think it's, as I've said before, it's up to our listeners in the EU to try to moderate this in their individual countries, because there's nothing I could do about it from here.
Just to make it even worse, I saw a piece, I think, in The Guardian that said some of these EU members voted wrongly, voted incorrectly because they
didn't understand what
voted. They voted for the wrong article because of the way it was structured. Oh, so some of those votes might actually not have been, they could theoretically have been against those articles. And one estimate I saw said that if they had voted the other way, they wouldn't have passed. So there's a voting issue there as well.
Unless you think this doesn't really matter, I think, I mean, this is an interpretation, but I think what we're actually seeing is the old incumbent media, chiefly in Germany, Axel Springer, the printed newspapers and magazines, who are terrified of the new media and internet, doing everything they can to disable or hobble the internet. And there's good reason to do it. We just got information on mobile viewing in the United States. 40% of mobile web traffic is YouTube. 40%.
Wow.
And this is a significant jump in time spent from 29 to 34% at the expense, by the way, of television. And so this is exactly what's happened to all sorts of incumbents, bookstores, grocery stores. When's the last time you went to a video rental store? This is what's been happening thanks to the internet. And now it's publishers' turn, and they're very scared. And television and newspapers and magazines, it's a changing environment.
And the funny thing is, they've actually had the longest amount of time to actually deal with the change because the web was all text in the beginning, you know?
Yeah.
So, and they're coming now with regulation or directives and all. And I get it. I do. It's just, where have you been for 25, 30 years?
Yeah. And I think a lot of those sort of the reaction to Google and to the internet and even to Facebook is an attempt to blame them for problems that have actually been going on for decades.
Right.
I mean, readership of newspapers started declining long before the internet came along because people had TV and radio.
Right.
So it's not as though Google and Facebook suddenly caused this sharp decline. They just caused the already existing decline to speed up a little bit.
This is a great from Nielsen, a great graph. This is 18 to 34 here. The blue is TV, and that includes DVR. From year over year, from 27% to 22%. And then the orange is watching the internet on a computer. That's gone from 29 to 34%. Big growth in the most important demographic from that point of view of advertisers, but also the point of view of the future. You know, if you go to adult 65 plus, these oldsters are still watching TV. A lot of it, 60%. But there's even a drop. I have to point out, there's even a drop there. You know, the others are TV-connected devices like game consoles or Rokus. That's green. Watching on an app is red. That's a small. That's interesting. App or web watching on a smartphone is a small. Red is tablet. And then orange is app or web on a smartphone. The light orange. That's so good. Never mind. Forget. Thank God there's an eraser on this thing. Just forget I even tried to make any sense of that at all. But you can see there's a definite trend to increase time spent on mobile. And not a surprise, frankly. Not a surprise at all. Let's see. What else? Tuesday. It's the end of the line for Allo, Google+, inbox. Am I leaving anything out? Probably. Oh, goo.gul, their URL shortener. The Google Graveyard. If you go to killedbygoogle.com, I think we did we show this last week? Or no, I just bookmarked this. These are all the things in chronological order. Killed by Google. And it's kind of a long scroll. Mm-hmm. Kind of a goes a long way. There's Google Now. Remember that? There's Google Code. There's Picasa. Oh, I remember that.
Some of those things have evolved into other things, though. I mean, Google Now is still part of your Google feed.
Is it?
Yes.
Really? Is that Google Now? What is that?
Yeah.
Google Reader? Yeah, sort of. I don't know. Sparrow? They bought it, then killed it.
Panoramio.
Panoramio. That was cool. Google Wave. Don't tell Gina Trapani. It's gone.
Remember Songza? That was cool.
Songza? Yeah. Google Flu Vaccine Finder. So remember, good. We talked a lot about how you could see how the flu vaccine was working all over. Why do they even... Why, Google? Why? This is a great site.
I know I don't know anything about this, but I was reading some commentary by someone about the very first one on the list, Google Fusion Tables, and they were saying that this was a hugely, you know, valuable thing to have, and lots of people used it and, in fact, built services around it, and then just poof, it's gone.
To be honest, this is why my wife, when we talked about Google Stadia, she said, don't tell me about any more Google stuff. They're not. I don't want to get involved. They're just going to break my heart. I forget it. And I think that's a genuine problem for Google is
people don't trust them. Like developers, you're not going to build anything into those on those services.
That because the whole pitch of Stadia was at the game developers conference. Come on, we need some games. No games. Please write some games. Would you do that?
Yeah, I mean, you wake up one morning and,
never mind.
We changed our minds. We're not doing that anymore.
That's as bad as writing a game to run on Facebook.
it's also bleeding into their hardware a little bit, in my opinion, and that's even worse.
Well, you are on a Pixelbook, right? Or you were. You love that Pixelbook.
Pixel Slate right now.
You're on a Slate. I love Pixelbook, but they didn't announce a new Pixelbook this year. They announced instead a Fakatka tablet. You like the tablet?
I love it.
Okay.
But I'm a different user. 50%.
You're different, all right.
No, you're different, all right. But I evaluated, and I recommend this to all the folks I write to or write about, you know, about Chromebooks. You need to think about what your own use case is. And for me, 50% of the time, I'm using a device to watch TV on YouTube TV or Hulu or Netflix and so on, and I prefer a tablet. The right. other 50% of the time, I am writing, coding, and so on, but I don't need, you know, a 14-hour typing device. So this is perfect for me.
I think one thing Google did that's a little difficult is that they have five models ranging in price from $600 to $1,600, and a normal person going to buy this is not going to know what's the difference between this and that. I don't even understand.
That's why I write articles about those.
Thank goodness there's about Chromebooks.com.
And there's no link tax.
At this point, you can't get the two bottom of the line.
The Celeron, no.
And they never had them?
They did. People have
you could pre-order them. So they never, once the, so if you didn't pre-order the day they announced it,
So Marquez Brownlee, he pre-ordered one and got one, and I think that was the beginning of the end for the seller.
He killed it. Quite honestly. Man, that guy's got some power.
I think that's a fair assessment. I don't know that for a fact.
Because he panned it, right?
He panned it.
Wow.
For some good reasons, no question. I do question Google's judgment in trying to bring a 3,000 by 2,000 display to a Celeron processor with 4 gig of RAM. And
did he say it wasn't fast enough? What did he say?
The biggest, he said a lot of things. Some I agree with, some I don't. The one I agree with and that most people took away from was very valid, and that is the animations when you're switching apps. Like when you go into like the overview mode, like on an iPad, when you see all your apps running, that's butter smooth, right? when you do that on Pixel Slate, or the one that he was using, it was janky, frame rate drops, stuttery, and I get it. And in Chrome OS 73, we may talk about that a little later in the show that just came out, that is supposed to address some of the issues. Does that mean that Celeron will be back? I don't know. I really don't know. But I question their judgment of even bringing that device out. And yeah, it is what it is.
I know Marcus has a lot of, you know, millions of subscribers on YouTube and is widely revered among geeks. But honestly, I don't think he carries that much weight in the general populace that is expected to buy this. I mean, maybe he killed it. I think it's much more likely Google put it out so that they could say starts at $599. Mm-hmm. Never intended to sell it, because that's too many SKUs just from the point of view of a consumer going to the store saying, I don't know what to get. Now they've got, they should actually take it off of this.
I would agree.
But
one point about Marquez's reach, I mean, we know he's got the geek following. He's got 7-8 million subscribers, however many it is, and he's earned every one of them. He's awesome. The thing is, Leo, it wasn't just the people who watched his video on YouTube. It was all of the other outlets picking up on it.
People repeated it, yeah.
Exactly. So that expanded the reach by a lot.
Sorry, I just started Marquez's
Marquez singing?
Page. I think so. This is his YouTube page. We'll give him a plug and increase his subscribers by about 5 people. He's got 8.2 million now. MKBHD on YouTube. Wow. I mean, if he has that much power, that's pretty impressive. I don't even know if in his heyday Walt Mossberg could have killed a Pixelbook. But maybe. And I think you're right. I think people listen to him, influencers listen to him, and then tell their friends, oh, no, don't get that one.
Right.
But honestly, we're also not talking about, I would guess, not vast quantities. They don't sell a lot of these.
No, and I think that's part of the problem with the pricing as well. Aside from numerous SKUs, Google doesn't move enough hardware to get really sweet deals on chips and so forth. Yeah. So, you know, it is what it is.
I would expect people buy Samsung Chromebooks or other inexpensive Chromebooks, premium Asus.
Asus, yeah.
Yeah.
The thing is, they could buy lower costing ones that were not as good, say, as the Pixelbook, Leo. But when you bought your Pixelbook, what other high-end Chromebooks were there?
Mm-hmm. Right. No, that's right. And I still love that Pixelbook. I think that's a really great device.
And what that device has done is gotten Asus and Dell and Lenovo to start selling $500, $600, $800, $900, $1,000 Chromebooks now.
Yeah.
So you have choice now.
What's the best-selling Chromebook out there right now?
Oh, I'm sure it's a low-cost one.
Yeah.
Maybe the Asus C302 Flip has been around for 2 years,
yeah,
and people love it. It sells like hotcakes, I think, and it just got a replacement that you can now order a refresh that just went available last week, or this week, rather.
One thing that you can get in non-Google hardware, I don't know, does Google sell it with an LTE radio?
No, they do not.
Yeah. So that's something desirable, I think, for a lot of people, is the ability to be always online. And Samsung and others do offer Chromebooks with LTE.
You know, the original did have that. I was at the launch.
Yeah, I remember.
We were at Kiko.
Yeah, and they stopped doing it.
Yep. Great idea.
Another thing Google killed. Put that in the graveyard and smoke it. Yeah, I mean, I'm looking. Here's a Chromebook from Acer, an 11-inch for $200. Those 11 inches typically are around $200. 14 inches, HP's got one, $225. And then you're right. There's like the Chromebook Plus, which is what my daughter uses in college. That's $500 from Samsung. And I think is a really nice piece of hardware. And, of course, you got aluminum body. That's one thing that's really happened
is
choice is really exploding.
We bought a Chromebook for our youngest when she went to university. Actually, we might have bought it when she was still in high school. And I still have it and use it as a sort of, you know, it's on the kitchen counter and I use it for this and that. It's not like a main work computer, but it still works great.
Yeah.
It's not the fastest, but
what do you recommend, Kevin? I mean, what do you, you recommend the Slate to people?
I tell them that if they're going to use it more as a laptop to get a Pixelbook or an Acer Chromebook Spin 13.
Yes. I think that's a nice choice. Yeah.
I mean, I listen, what I use is not best for everybody. I state that repeatedly. So depends on what you need it to do. You know, the $200 laptops, Leo, that you just said, very capable devices. They're Celerons, maybe 4 gig of RAM, 720p displays. But if that's all you want to check for email and browse, $200 well spent.
Right.
I often recommend older users.
I recommend it for people who want secure banking and things like that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
You can use your Windows laptop, but you'll be, you know, for you want to stay secure, use a Chromebook.
I just wish they hadn't killed stuff like Inbox. I really liked Inbox.
April 2nd, end of the line.
It was great. What was wrong with it?
And unlike Microsoft, when Google kills something, you can't use it anymore.
It's dead.
It's dead.
Yeah.
You could still use Windows XP if you should have a mind, but you can't use Inbox after Tuesday.
Nope. And I mean, Allo, I never used Allo. Did you guys use Allo?
Well, Jeff and I joke about it. We messaged each other when Allo launched, and that's the last time we used it.
I forgot it even existed, so I'm not worried about
that. Had Google said, this is our future going forward in messaging, we want all Android devices to use it, we want Google Fi users to use it, Allo was a great messaging tool. It could have survived. That's just Google not giving it any steam. Yeah.
But I mean, messaging, we've talked about, this before. Messaging is the worst example of Google at its worst. One point, what, they had like five or something, and it wasn't clear which ones they were sort of investing in, and should you be using Hangouts, should you be using, you know, it was just, and multiple teams, it was just nuts.
They're pushing RCS now, this rich communication system, over SMS. Allo didn't do, as I remember, Allo did not do RCS, and they want you to use Messenger, which is Android Messenger, which is the messenger that comes on your Samsung phone in addition to Samsung Messenger.
Yeah.
It has pretty much the same icon, the same name.
Yeah.
One's green, one's blue. It's very confusing. And the reason I mentioned Samsung is, as well as the Pixel 3 has done, and there's new models apparently coming, we'll talk about that in a second, by far the biggest Android handset out there is Samsung. By a long shot. Number two, number one phone manufacturer in the world. Number two is Apple, or Huawei, depending on which way the wind's blowing. So really, the experience most people have of Android is on Samsung, and it's extremely confusing because you get the Android messenger from Google plus the messenger from Samsung, and then, you know, you can, if you want, download Allo and messages, Hangouts.
Sure. You know, internally, there's just too many teams trying to do too many different things, and this is just strictly opinion from being on the inside. It's just a coordination effort, too many competing priorities, you know, different visions.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot you were a contractor at Google. Did you have any insight into what was going on at the time?
I dog-fooded Allo for 8 months before you even saw it. Yeah.
I mean, wow.
Yeah.
I bet you liked it.
I actually did. I liked it a lot. But the thing is, again, just as you said, too many different competing apps that do the same thing. Plus, with the Android, you know, licensing terms, a Samsung or somebody can create their own. So now you've got two or three duplicates of the same thing just from, you know, a messenger app. It's a
mess. But I have to wonder, like, if someone in Google says, you know what we need? We need another messaging app. Wouldn't a bunch of people put their hands up and say, well, as it turns out, we already have five. And so, you know, maybe we don't need another one.
Well, Allo, was Allo, because Allo's whole claim to fame was it used Google Assistant. And it had the smart replies that were built in the inbox. And so it must have been from the AI assistant division, right?
Okay.
That was their thing, right? Is that right, Kevin?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a secret, and I don't think we'll get in trouble for saying it now. Just about every decision from a product standpoint that I heard of or was involved with there, not that I was making the decisions, just to be clear, it was all about how do we get AI and the cloud in this product.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, pretty evident based on the products we've seen since.
And by the way, that's not a bad strategy. That's a very sensible strategy. It's a lot better than the Vic Gundotra era strategy. How do we get social into everything?
True.
Yeah.
That didn't work out so well.
But what Google doesn't do a great job of, I don't think, is kind of make clear this is an experiment, you know, and we're going to learn stuff from it, but we're probably going to shut it off at some point, or we might, because people, you know, they download these things and they start using them and then they become parts of their lives, even Google Plus for that matter. And then it's just suddenly, we're not doing that. So,
yeah. Yeah, well, we rag on Google almost every week for their messaging strategy. Only because I use Hangouts, and I want it to survive or something like it.
Yeah,
I'd like a unified strategy that here's what I need, and I don't think I'm alone. Something that works on the desktop. Android Messages does that, sort of. Thumbs up. Something that works on iOS. Mm-hmm. Hangouts does that. Hangouts is all three. That's pretty much it. And something that will work with my SMS on my phone, whether I use a Pixel or a Samsung. And Hangouts is the closest thing they've got right now, but I don't think Hangouts is going to last very... I think Hangouts is soon to join that
graveyard. So what was the problem with Hangouts?
Yeah, what's the problem with Hangouts?
Yeah, I don't understand.
I don't know. I mean, I'm sad to see that go because that's how Stacy and I communicate for our IoT things. And I know that Hangouts Meet is going to like the G Suite side, and I don't think that's what you're talking about, Leo. You don't want that. You want a consumer.
No, although I was talking with Lisa this morning. She says, well, I use Hangouts. They're not killing it. I use it on G Suite. And I said, yes, they are. It's going to be chat for text and then Meet for video and audio calls.
Right.
And will that'll be automatically replacing Hangouts, or will she'll have to download those, won't she?
I think it wouldn't surprise me if she gets it in a app update to Hangouts if she's got a G Suite signed.
That's almost worse because then you have Hangouts there and now it's something else.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, and the something else doesn't do all the things that Hangouts did. And by the way, if you're a Google Fi subscriber, as I am, you still use Hangouts.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's all been worked out yet. I just couldn't tell you.
It's crazy.
This is why I'm using an iPhone these days. Sorry.
That's why I actually... And the other problem has been the Pixel 3 reliability, and there's been a lot of complaints about this. I love the camera on the Pixel 3, and I like a pure Google experience. But once the Samsung S10 Plus came out, there's no competition. It's just a much more reliable phone. Not more affordable, but much more reliable phone that works better. It's got better screen, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think Google needs to figure something out. I don't know what.
But anyway. I feel like the messaging stuff at least, and even the social stuff, it was so clearly not anything that core Google kind of cared about deeply because it didn't really involve, well, social did involve search, and it sort of tangentially involved search, but it always felt like these things were kind of, you know, toys for engineers to play with, but not real products, not things that would affect Google deeply enough that they would sort of care about them.
Yeah. So that brings us to Stadia. And we already talked about it a little bit because this was announced last week at the... Every time I go to CNET now in Brave, it says, this site is stealing login credentials is bad. I can't go to CNET anymore, I guess. what? So, that was Variety. Come on, Brave. Chill out.
Oops.
There we go. Google Stadia, great article by Trevor Rubin in Variety, is a net neutrality nightmare. And... it points out the real Achilles heel of Stadia, which is, yes, Google has lots of server capacity. They're going to put high-end graphics processors, especially designed AMD GPUs, in every instance. So you'll have what they said, that you'll have 10 teraflops. Was it teraflops? Teraflops of processing performance compared to the 3 or 4 in a PS4 Pro or an Xbox One S. And they'll even be able to combine instances if you really need it. It'll be great for cooperative play because you and your friend can be playing, sitting on the couch together. And you'll each have your own instance, even though they show up as one on the screen, et cetera, et cetera. All sorts of really great things. Sounds wonderful, except that they're completely at the mercy of the last mile, your internet service provider. And the Variety article raises a really interesting point. Now that they don't have to pay lip service to net neutrality, watch and see. I wouldn't be surprised at all if Comcast and Verizon and AT&T, if I don't get something in the mail from my ISP, Comcast, in a few months saying, you know, for best performance, Google Stadia requires our special low latency connection for a mere $5 a month.
Well, and it would be a perfect perfect pitch because they know that gamers are obsessed about that.
Yes, I'll pay it.
If I'm reading websites, I don't actually care if it loads in 11 right. seconds or 2.7 right. seconds. But your game is going to be
huge,
you know, unplayable.
Huge.
Well, I don't disagree, but I question how many true quote unquote gamers are even going to do this because
are going to use it.
Well, yeah, it needs some games. That would be a place to start.
Well, yeah, it needs games, but people have already invested. I mean, true gamers have invested.
That's a good point.
Thousands of dollars.
That's a good point. They already have an Xbox or PlayStation or a gaming
and they're playing it online. And they don't care as much.
Yeah.
This is to me. This is the bigger opportunity for people who haven't spent, you know, $2,000 on the latest GTX video card and everything else. And that opens up a tremendous potential opportunity for these people. Yeah, I could see the ISPs jumping in here, but I was actually happy about Stadia personally. I'm like, I can use my Pixel Slate for something else now.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think you're right. There's probably a fairly big chunk of potential gamers, kind of casual gamers, you know, who they're never going to build their own rig. They're never going to get the latest, you know, console, but they might be willing to use Stadia.
Yeah, I mean, they're getting access to high-end hardware on the cheap.
And certainly it's the case that there are existing streaming gaming solutions. I play GeForce Now on my Shield, my NVIDIA Shield, and that plays quite. I haven't had any problems with latency. Have you?
No, it's been great. I mean, I don't know what your ISP or who it is or what your.
I'm on a pretty fast Comcast connection, but
cable. On a gigabit FiOS connection.
So. Well, shut up.
That's enough out of you.
I still wouldn't be surprised, even though you and I clearly don't need it. If we didn't get emails from Verizon and Comcast respectively saying, you really have to get our special new gaming connection to play.
So they're going
to
start the letter. Hey, that's a nice, those are some nice games you got there. It'd be a shame if something was to happen to them.
Yeah. I think the challenge for Google is going to be they have no presence in gaming at all. Microsoft was very quick after the Google announcement. I think a lot of us, including me watching this, saying this is a shot across the bow of Microsoft and Sony, because both are planning similar services. Microsoft was very quick to respond last week saying, wait till we get to E3. We'll have some announcements for you. They have a streaming service they're planning to launch next year. And the advantage Microsoft has is that they have a lot of games. They have their own Microsoft Studio games, which are very popular, and they have relationships with all the big gaming companies. They already offer many of these games on the Xbox Gold. What is it? The Xbox Plus service, where you can subscribe, but you still download them. They're not streaming. And Sony is in the same boat. Nintendo's in the same boat. These companies already have relationships. Google's starting from scratch. Going to be very challenging.
It's definitely an uphill battle. It's we'll have to see. It all comes down to content. Content is king.
Yep.
The other one that I wouldn't discount is Amazon and Twitch, because what we didn't talk about, maybe probably last week, was the YouTube factor here with Stadia. It, I think, is huge, and Amazon could pull the same thing with Twitch.
Yeah.
Is that a case of Google doing so? Clearly, some even said this is to save YouTube. I think that's an overstatement. But as they pointed out during the event, YouTube sells or offers a lot of gaming downloads. Billions of people watch YouTube gaming videos, not the live streaming so much, but the gaming videos to learn how to play a game and so forth. Obviously, they see a threat from Twitch, Amazon's live streaming gaming service. They did offer some unique features in YouTube. You mentioned one of them, the ability to be watching a gameplay and then pick up right where that gameplay is right now by pushing a button and you're streaming it on Stadia. There's also the ability to package a current position in a game and offer that. So somebody like Ninja could say, all right, this is a great chance for you to try Fortnite, except Fortnite won't be on this, but this is a great chance for you to try Fortnite. Here's a download you could pick up right where I've left off. That's cool. The ability to stream directly to YouTube from Stadia. That's cool. Although we'll see. I mean, they didn't say anything about an inset of the gamer or a chat room or any of the features that makes Twitch really powerful for those guys who are streaming, gals and guys who are streaming. So, but on the other hand, that's Google shoring up its own business as opposed to giving gamers what they want, right? It's sometimes, a lot of times companies do this, and I always wonder when, especially in Silicon Valley, when companies are solving their business problem ahead of solving their consumers' problems.
See, you're going back to the gamers. They're not solving the today's gamers' problem. They are solving the non-gamers' problem.
But are the non-gamers asking for those features, or are those features designed for YouTube to succeed against Twitch? You see what I'm saying?
I do. I see what you're saying, but I think there's just, I mean, how many people in the U.S. have a custom-built gaming rig or spent...
I agree. I understand. In fact, I said that during the Stadia launch. This is not for current mainstream gamers. Right. But those features sound like they're trying to woo Ninja away from Twitch, right? If you're going to save YouTube with this, you got to woo the Twitch guys.
Well, they might as well try. Like, if they can get a sort of broad mass of kind of either non-gamers or casual gamers, and they can kind of chip away at Amazon and Twitch, then why not?
It's a win all around. And see, this
they've got nowhere to go but up.
Yeah. There's an advantage of starting at zero,
The game developers themselves, I mean, at first I was like, ooh, they're not going to want to be on this thing because they got to port their games over to Linux because the Stadia hardware is Linux, yada, yada. But then I'm like, wait, unless it's an exclusive thing, they can still have their millions and millions of sales to regular true PC gamers and add on to that through, you know, the bigger audience of non-gamers that say, hey, I can play these awesome games, you know, and not buy $2,000 worth of hardware.
Mm-hmm. Well, and here's the funny thing, because that's exactly what Apple announced on Monday is our Apple Arcade, which, again, like Stadia, won't be available till the fall. We don't know how much it's going to cost. There are a lot of big question marks, and they don't have any games for it. So they're actually saying to developers, we want you to develop a game exclusively for Apple Arcade. You can't, not only can you not sell it on Android, you can't even sell it on Apple. People have to play it through Arcade with their one price subscription. And developers now go to work. and I think that's a tough pitch, especially if you're a developer that is making good money on the App Store. But look how much Epic makes on Fortnite in-game purchases, which would not be eligible for Apple Arcade. They make billions.
So what are the distribution? What's the distribution deal for a game developer in Apple Arcade?
Well,
I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, here's Oprah said it on stage when she was standing there. A billion pockets, y'all.
A billion pockets.
It's in a billion pockets. That's the distribution offer. I don't know how many people subscribe to Apple Arcade. Certainly not the full billion, but the fact that you're on a billion devices and available on a billion devices is probably fairly compelling.
Well, and I think also Apple's...
wait, you can't say that. And then
Oprah said it. I didn't say it. Oprah said it.
You can't agree with Oprah because Stadia, for example, can run probably on 2 billion devices.
That's true. It can run on all of those. Plus, run on every iPhone and every Android phone,
tablets,
and every Chromebook, and even on Chromecasts.
Yeah, and TVs. Exactly.
We don't know if Stadia is exclusive. We know Apple's exclusive. Stadia may not be exclusive. In fact, I don't think they need to make it exclusive. The pitch of Stadia is you could play this game on this cheap device, this $35 or $60.
Or this $1,000 pixel slate, you fool. Yeah.
I think the sweet spot for this, I don't know what Google's sweet spot, but from the player's sweet spot, is a Chromecast Ultra, $75, and then you really want the best experience, you buy the Wi-Fi Google controller, which reduces latency because it's correct, just like the Chromecast connecting directly. That's a pretty sweet bundle. So I don't know what you've spent there because they didn't announce a price for that, but let's say $200 and then whatever the monthly fee, which they also didn't announce. So let's say $20. That might be pretty cool. But then it sounds like you're a gamer, and maybe if you are, you already had a Xbox.
But maybe, I mean, there's lots of kids. You're not going to let your kid. You're not going to, no, lots of people are going to do it, but not everyone's going to give their kid an Xbox One or a Plus or whatever. Or a
so the kids will demand these. Daddy, I want a Chromecast Ultra.
And then you can grow future gamers, right?
Yeah.
So if you can get them young, maybe they'll get used to it. Maybe they'll even like it. And as it gets better and you add more features, more games.
They're probably already watching these games on YouTube now.
Yeah, that's true. And they did mention, and I have to say, I was thrilled to hear this, cooperative gaming, because Lisa says, my wife, I want to sit on the couch and play a game with you. Like GoldenEye. Remember GoldenEye? Two people could be.
Yeah.
And I looked, and it's like the Lego game is the only game you can do that with. Yeah. And we didn't want to play. So that's one of the things Google explicitly called out at the Stadia announcement is cooperative gaming. And because each person will have their own instance in the cloud, it'll be good quality. You can actually be at different places in the world. And I mean, and she could sit there with her Pixel Book, or I could have the big screen. I mean, there's really some options here. And I could see this being a family gaming opportunity.
You guys should play Jackbox.
What's Jackbox?
Ever play that?
No.
So it's their games. I think it started with You Don't Know Jack. Do you remember that game?
Love that. Played that many years. Yeah.
So Jackbox, effectively, it's all it does is multiplayer games. We played it at a family reunion kind of thing with nieces and nephews and cousins. And there's a game where you're called Quiplash, where you have to come up with stupid sort of funny sayings.
It's party one games.
Party games. But they're really well done.
They won't let me look at it unless I give them an email address.
Just use Matthews.
Yeah. Anyway, they're fun. You should check them out.
Did Apple say what developers will get as a cut of the $9.99 monthly fee?
First of all, they didn't say $9.99. We don't know what it is. The deal for Apple News, we should talk about Apple News too, since you both are journalism types. The deal for Apple News, according to the Wall Street Journal, is
50%.
It's 50%. So it's $9.99. Oh, I subscribed immediately because I used to subscribe to Texture. It's the same, same price. Yeah. Apple keeps $5. The rest of the money gets distributed based on engagement time. So. And so that was another interesting announcement.
Yeah.
Well, I'm really curious. Both of you have had experiences in print and have watched print struggle. A lot of people blame Facebook for the end of journalism. This is Apple. Is it Apple's attempt to save journalism, or is it Apple's attempt to draw the last drop of blood out before they toss away the corpse?
I'm going to go with number two, option number two.
I'll take number two for the win.
Okay.
I mean, if they wanted to save journalism, they could not take 50%. Like, that would be suggestion number one.
Yeah.
If you're going to try and help media companies, you would not take 50% of the revenue. It feels to me.
Yesterday, we were talking about it on MacBreak Weekly, and I said, the thing I hate about this is it's a walled garden. And it's not the web. And everybody yelled at me. They said, well, no, this is great. You want a walled garden. This is web? I can still look at the web. Yeah, but this doesn't interact with the web. This draws resources from the web. No, this doesn't hurt the web. And that's what really worries me more than anything, is that journalism, as soon as it becomes a walled, who were we talking to that worked for The Daily? Rupert Murdoch's crazy,
hugely successful tablet newspaper.
Yes, he spent $100 million or something building a newsroom and hiring journalists. And somebody we talked to regularly was one of those journalists.
Wow,
yeah,
that would have been fun. Yeah. Fun times.
Yeah, back when
were pretty good there for a little
while. I call stupid money.
Until they launched us.
Rupert's doing okay. Rupert's doing fine. Rupert's not hurting.
He loses $20 million. Estimated a year on the New York Post.
And he doesn't care.
$20 million. And he's lost that for 15 years.
Why does he still do it?
Because he doesn't care. He wants the New York Post.
It's
and
power.
He doesn't care.
It's power.
$20 million is nothing.
He makes so much money off for Fox that he subsidizes it.
It's a rounding error.
And it gives him a voice in Manhattan, an important voice.
Yeah.
It's for power.
So Apple, I mean, you know, a bunch of people, Josh Benton at the Nieman Journalism Lab did quite a good piece on News Plus. It's, I don't see why. And in fact, the New York Times and the Washington Post decided not to take part, but I don't actually see, I think it's like a Hail Mary pass for a lot of publishers. They're like, well, who cares? Like, Apple is in a billion pockets. Maybe we only get 50% of whatever pennies people contribute, but at least we'll get something, and maybe it won't cost us a lot. And so why not? I mean, we're literally so desperate.
That's what it is. It's a it's
if your Aunt Sally set up a lemonade stand and said she'd put your paper there, they would go for it.
Right.
because
that's really what's happening, is that these all these magazines are dying on the vine. And a billion pockets, y'all. Well,
right.
If I make one penny for pocket, I can.
I thought it was fascinating, though. The Wall Street Journal is part of it. So the New York Times.
Oh, but they're not fully a part of it. Right. We should point this out. No, they're not.
They are.
No, you get
They are. Everything from the journal is in there.
No.
So that's what's yes, that's what's fascinating.
No,
so
you're
I did
wrong.
Some research. No, everything from the journal is in there, but they are only going to surface general news. So it will only show up sort of in your feed or in the highlights, general news. Everything from the journal is in there, but only if you search for it. So if you know a specific keyword or you know a headline, you can find it. But I think they're counting on the fact that like 99% of people are not going to do that. They're just going to get whatever journal stuff comes to them. So they're actually trying to you know, have their cake and eat it too. Put your content there, but actually only highlight the general news that you don't care about.
So I could so for instance, I pay $149 for the journal digital subscription. The difference between this and Apple News is, for one thing, Apple News only keeps it for 3 days. You can't go past 3 days.
Right.
And then you're saying all the content is there, because I apologize for saying you're wrong. Obviously, you know what you're talking about. What I had read is that only a few things would be from the paper would be on Apple News. You're saying it's all there. It's just not surfaced.
Exactly. So the journal's own reporting on it said
they should know, right?
almost all or virtually all. So who knows? There's probably some stuff that isn't on there, but most of it is. You just won't be able to find it. I don't know if you've tried the search, but it's terrible. And there, you can't browse anything. You can't say, hey, show me everything from the journal. So you're only going to see the stuff that Apple's editors highlight.
Yeah. Right.
And that'll be just the general news.
But that's a good offer. That's a good deal for the journal, because the journal's going to get basically plugs on the front page of Apple News. Right. But if you really want to see more,
you're going to have to go to the site.
You're going to have to either go to the site.
It's also interesting that the journal is hiring 50 people. And they tied it to this launch. So they said, being part of News Plus, they're going to hire 50 people.
What?
Just to report on things, some of which might actually be exclusive to News Plus, non-business related. I just find that fascinating. It feels like a daily kind of thing. Like Murdoch is just, what the hell? Apple's really big. Let's just hire a bunch of journalists.
This is, though, that's that stupid money I was talking about. If you make enough money from another source, say Fox, you can play with it. You've got, you know, you've got...
It's the downside.
I mean, I would do that if, you know, in a little way. You know, if I had $100 a month discretionary income, I wouldn't care. And for Rupert...
A 5 or a 10.
Yeah. For Rupert, it's probably the equivalent of $100 a month. It's like, well, let's just...
So what?
I'll buy a lottery ticket. What the hell?
I think the long-term risk is that if people figure it out and they do start getting more journal content... Some of them could decide to stop subscribing.
That's the next. That's the next step.
That kills the golden goose.
Which is for blogs like 9to5Mac and Apple Insider to start publishing the tricks to searching Apple News and getting Wall Street Journal articles. But there is no there are no inbound links, right? You can't.
No.
You have
it's
to,
a classic Apple product.
It's
not connected to anything.
Nothing goes in. Nothing goes out.
It's literally just like a newsstand, but on your tablet. Yeah. And it's interesting to me, sort of in an academic way, that they place so much emphasis on no algorithms, no data, no privacy. We don't know anything about you. We don't know what you read. We don't know where you live.
That's Apple.
And I actually had somebody say, I like recommendations made by companies that know me and what I read. So Apple's basically saying, we're just going to choose a bunch of stuff. We have no idea whether you're going to be interested in it because we literally don't know you.
We don't know or care. Yeah. I tried to get rid of People magazine in my Apple News Plus.
It's a very retro approach, right? It's like the guy at the newsstand and the people who put the newspaper together didn't know you either.
Right.
And you would think.
Is it really that bad, though, Matthew, from a anonymous? Don't they. Aren't they using some algorithms to recommend based on what
they're doing
on
device algorithms?
Yeah.
So right, but even those don't, they said they will not track what you read.
Right.
Well, they will not track could mean on the server side in Apple, but on the device.
Your phone's tracking you. It's just not telling anybody.
Well, I'm just not going to get random articles.
I have to say, as a regular user of Apple News, because I try it all the time, it's not doing a great job of figuring out what I want to read. At all.
And I have to say, it is like going to the newsstand and reading through random
headlines.
It's
very much like that, which is the serendipity of that could be fun.
Sure. And that definitely has value. But I think things like Flipboard and even Facebook, God love them, who do kind of recommendations. Every now and then there is something that is interesting that you would not have found otherwise. So now you're counting on Apple's editors, who nobody knows how many of them there are or who they are, to sort of select those things for you.
I've been asking every show since the Apple event, every panel, Apple really is selling this privacy, right? And it's obviously in contrariness to Google and Facebook, right? Well, they snoop on you, they collect data, but we promise we won't. And they see that as a selling point. And of course, in the tech press, we're very aware of all this. We see it as a selling point. My question that I ask every panel, and I'll ask you guys this, do real people care? Do they, I mean, I know they're aware of it because we've been hammering this for years, but do people, when you go out in the world, say, oh, I'm going to choose Apple because they stand for privacy?
Experience, no.
Yeah.
I've never heard that from anyone. In the list of reasons why people say they choose Apple, that does not appear.
Right.
Like, I like the rose gold cases is
that's
probably
much
number
higher.
One.
Yeah.
iMessage is number two.
Yeah.
No one has ever mentioned privacy.
There is, I think, a somewhat subliminal awareness of security, right? Like, people think, oh, I don't want to use an Android phone because I hear Apple phones are safer.
Mm-hmm.
But not more private. I don't know if
I
that
have
really,
not heard that.
Not even heard
so
that.
So no one has actually specifically mentioned it.
I don't really hear the privacy as a selling factor either. I do hear a lot about the security. Obviously, writing about Google devices, I get my occasional comment there, you're buying spyware because Google's spying and so on. And so forth. But the privacy factor, I don't think normals really care actively.
I don't even have people talking to me about, oh, there was a huge leak and all these passwords. Like, I just don't think a lot of that stuff... It's complicated. I just don't think it affects people in their daily lives unless they get hacked or unless, they get phished somehow. I did have one conversation about Apple and security or privacy, and I pointed out that they're what to me is just a massive hypocrisy, the way they treat users in China. So they're happy to protect your data and not snoop and so on if you're not in China, but... In China, they pretty much do whatever the government tells them to do.
Right.
So all of that data is available. Even, I think, encryption keys are stored locally.
Yeah, the keys are stored in China as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's another issue. Mr. Pichai goes to Washington. And the president tweeted about it. He met with Donald Trump in D.C., today, I think, right? Or was it yesterday? Trump said that he tweeted that Sundar Pichai met with him and is obviously doing quite well. That's nice. That's nice. I like to get that inside look.
What does that mean, though, obviously? What does he mean?
No. Yeah, it kind of implies there's something nefarious, right? Like, oh, Google's doing well. You guys don't have a GM, don't have a job, but Google's doing okay. No, I don't think that's what he said.
Was he wearing the diamond Rolex again? Or like, what does he mean?
That's for Trump. He was wearing nice shoes. He had good, expensive shoes. Yeah. He's doing quite well. This is also from the Twitter. He stated strongly that he is totally committed to the U.S. military, not the Chinese military.
In case you were
it's
wondering.
It's like a freaking toddler's writing this. Also discussed political fairness and the various things that Google can do for our country. Meeting ended very well.
Like facial recognition.
Meeting ended good. On Google's part, a spokesperson said, we're pleased to have productive conversations with the president about him. Shouldn't you capitalize president? Let me ask you journalists, guys. Is it lowercase p?
It's lowercase p unless you're referring to him in his official capacity, like President Donald Trump.
Okay.
Then it's capitalized.
Then the president. About investing in the future of the American workforce, the growth of emerging technologies, and our ongoing commitment to working with the U.S. government. Earlier, I guess, this month, Trump had accused Google of helping China and their military. So Sundar said, I just want you to know, we like the U.S. military. We prefer the U.S. military.
In case you hadn't figured that out already.
Yeah. And then, of course, Trump and Republicans have accused all social media, including Google, of having a bias towards Democrats. Trump tweeted earlier this month, Google is helping China and their military, but not the U.S. Terrible. The good news is they helped crooked Hillary Clinton and not Trump. And how did that turn out? It's like a freaking toddler. It's just, oh, I can't. Man. Okay. How did that turn out? So I can kind of read between the lines. Google, of course, because their engineers kind of rose up, decided to decline to do any work for the military's, was it the Jedi? They didn't bid for Jedi, which Microsoft has done, as well as Oracle. Microsoft's CEO, Satya Nadella, said, even though he was also getting some heat from engineers at Microsoft, said, well, we've always done contract work for any, what did he say, legally elected government, democratically elected government. And it's patriotic, I think Jeff Bezos said, because they are bidding for it as well. It's patriotic to support the military. What are you talking about? Google did decline. But I think Google did it not because they didn't want the money or they didn't think they weren't patriotic. But honestly, you got to keep your engineers happy. Mm-hmm. And if a lot of engineers are saying, whatever you do, don't sell our work for the military, you kind of don't have a lot of choice. It's not like you can fire them all.
Yeah, it was Project Maven too, wasn't it?
Maven.
They were, yeah. To use AI to get to help drones
right.
target people.
That was what it was. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Face recognition.
But yeah, they were
drones.
In the running for Jedi too.
Yeah. So that's why Sundar Pichai had to go to the White House and tell the president that we are committed to the U.S. military, not the Chinese military. The great thing about President Trump is you can just go in there, you can pat him on the back, give him a hearty handshake, say, no, we love you. And then he believes it.
Yeah.
Okay, never mind. Forget what I said. Forget that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff told the Senate that Google was working directly or indirectly counter to U.S. interests. Forget that.
But you know, an hour and a half from now, he's just going to say the complete opposite.
I know.
Right?
It must be hard for these CEOs. You can see Tim Cook almost literally grinding his teeth. Sitting there next to the president.
Painful to watch.
Yeah. But you have to do this. You have to kiss the ring. You can't not go. And especially now, I think Google, Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon all understand that they are in deep doo-doo. And they've got to appease the U.S. government.
Because there's a big antitrust hammer.
Oh, yeah.
Just sort of waiting.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, at this point, they might actually prefer Trump to somebody like Elizabeth Warren, who wants to break him up. Remember the EU? We were talking about them earlier. Remember the fact that they fined Google €1.5 billion for monopolistic behavior? Yeah. Turns out the same day, Google's price went up 2%, adding $17 billion to the market value, 10 times the amount they were fined by the European Commission.
Yeah.
So this is why Google's glad to pay that.
Yep. A good day on the street.
But then there's the guy, I love this, who made... How many?
$122 million.
$122 million.
Yeah. I love that story.
Sending phony bills to Facebook and Google, which they just paid. Now he did get
one.
He did get caught.
That one, the Schadenfreude, was pretty was pretty strong. I mean, it was total fraud. He pretended to be a company that they actually bought hardware from.
He just sent them invoices.
But I just love the fact. Yeah, they would just pay them.
The invoices were accompanied by forged invoices, contracts, and letters that falsely appear to be executed and signed by executives and agents of the victim companies, Facebook and Google, and which bore false corporate stamps embossed with the victim's company's names, to be submitted to banks in support of the large volume of funds that were fraudulently transmitted via wire transfer. He's in Lithuania.
Yeah.
No one
checked. The interesting part is he's only agreed to give back $50 million.
He made.
So that leaves like $72 million. Yeah. What's going to happen to that?
Well, probably they can't find it because apparently he squirreled cash away in Cyprus, Lithuania, Hungary, Slovakia, and Latvia. He does face up to 30 years in prison.
True. So that's the downside.
So we're not recommending this.
Yeah.
But
there was a company actually in Canada that used a similar strategy, didn't create a real company name, but would send out fake invoices. And I think the name of the company was something generic like Telecom Services. And there was a picture of a phone. And then it would, normal looking invoice, and right at the bottom in tiny print, it said, "This is not an invoice." And so we would send it to, you know, old ladies and like people on mailing lists and to some companies, and they would just pay. Because they're like, "Oh, okay, I guess we used some telecom services." And he would make it for such small amounts that nobody would.
I bet this happens all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not convinced we wouldn't fall for such a thing. I don't know. I mean, we have a full-time bookkeeper. We at least,
Lisa's
a CFO and with long-time experience as a controller. I'm going to have to ask her. Hey, if somebody were, you know, Matthew, would you send us an invoice and just see if we pay it?
Services rendered.
Services rendered. Make up a good name. Make it in Canada.
I thought it was interesting. This guy's company was actually registered, I think, in Lithuania. But the company he pretended to be, I don't think it even had business in Lithuania. So I guess nobody even noticed.
Nobody even checked. Oh, I don't think it would work with us because we're not that big and we kind of know what we're spending money on. But Google, you got to figure Google's got hundreds of invoices a day, right? At least.
Oh, yeah. Thousands.
Yeah, thousands. Why I have 4 electric bills this month?
Yeah. Maybe.
See, to be honest, the reason I kind of laugh is because I could see myself doing that, paying bills, sitting down. You sit down to pile in bills. Well, you write checks. I remember writing checks. You just write checks for everybody.
Yeah.
Lick it, hope they don't cut off the electricity and mail it. The case of the Lithuanian lapser. Let's take a little break. When we come back, I want to talk about Chrome 73. Kevin Toefel is here from aboutchromebooks.com. He has much to say about the new Chrome OS 73, including features not mentioned by the big Goog. Matthew Ingram is also here. He is the chief digital writer at the Columbia Journalism Review at cjr.org. And it's great to have you guys. It's fun. It's just, for me, it's like just sitting down and chatting with my old buddies about all the silly stuff happening today.
Chat and chew.
Where is that?
It's somewhere in Northern Ontario.
You know, somewhere in Northern Ontario sounds like that sounds like a Neil Young song, actually.
Yeah.
It is. Somewhere in Northern Ontario. Our show today brought to you by Capterra. Whether you're somewhere in Northern Ontario or in the heart of the city, in the Big Apple or the Big Orange, you got a business, you need business software. And I have to say, I remember working when I first started working at KMBR in San Francisco in 1984. So, I mean, PCs were out, Macs were out. And I was a music director, and I went into the music office to put together the playlists for the DJs. And they said, "There's your computer that generates a playlist." It was a PDP-11. And it was running software off a big 8-inch floppy, 8.5-inch floppy. And they said, "Here's the software." It's 1984. You put the floppy in, you close the thing, and you push the button. It would go, the head would go, chunk, and then it would spit out a playlist. The very first thing I did was break that. I don't know what happened, but the floppy stopped working one day shortly after I was employed. And we managed to get something a little more modern. And that's when we had to search for a little more modern software. I hope you're not in a situation where you're using software designed for Internet Explorer 8, but if you are, can I point you to Capterra, C-A-P-T-E-R-R-A, the place to find modern business software that will change your life from accounting to zookeeping. Capterra has it all, over 700 categories of software, everything from project management to email marketing to yoga studio management. And they make it easy to find because not only can you search for the category, but you can narrow it down by checking boxes saying it has to do this, it shouldn't do this, I want it to be like this. You can make a comparison chart of all of the programs that look best to you and see side by side. And then here's the best part. Over 800,000 reviews from real users of that software. 800,000 verified user reviews. So you can really get a good sense of whether this software is going to do what you want it to do, whether people are happy with it. Everything you need to make an informed decision. How much would you pay for a service like that? $10 a month? $20 a month? How about free? Free. No, there's no upsell. There's no Capterra Pro. Just that, free. Join the millions of people who use Capterra every month to find the right tools for their business. Don't suffer with that old piece of software that was written back in the 60s when you could use Capterra to find the best new software. Capterra, Capterra.com/twig. Do me a favor, use that URL, Capterra.com/twig, so they know that you heard it here. We appreciate them supporting our show, Capterra.com/twig, and we appreciate you supporting it. And in return, we're going to give you this great free service that tells you exactly what you need to know about the best software for your business. Capterra, software selection simplified. So Chrome OS 73 is now stable and arriving on Chromebooks. It's what sometimes I don't know that there's an update. How will I know that there's an update, Kevin Toefel?
So you've got the Chrome releases blog, which you're showing on the screen right now, which when I was at Google, I would say, guys, better release notes. And they're slowly doing that because before it used to be, we've got a new release, you know, check for updates and they never tell you what was in it. So at least we're getting bullet points now. But your Chromebook should automatically show a notification at the bottom right system tray.
It's not immediately obvious. It's like a little funny little notification, right?
Correct. And the thing is, and a lot of people don't realize this, even though Chrome OS is announced when a stable channel update is available, like it was on Monday this week, it's a staged rollout. And they actually, I think they do it to 5% of users for a day, then another 10% a day. So my tip of the week, or one of two actually, will be to tell you or show you a place that you can bookmark and see if your device is ready to get the update. Because you can always manually check for updates. Nice.
And in most cases, on an update like this, you need to restart the system, right?
Well, that's correct. Yes, technically. And one of the reasons Chrome is very quick with updates for actually applying them is, and I don't know if everybody realizes this, so I'll quickly go through it. There's actually two system partitions on every Chromebook. One is the active Chrome OS that you're using, and there's a backup of the last version. And what happens is the update gets downloaded and is installed to the partition not in use. When you reboot, it then boots into the new one, and therefore everything's seamlessly updated because it already is updated, if that makes sense.
If you were to suggest to somebody who wasn't super wealthy or super techie to get a Chromebook, which one would you suggest?
Well, the first thing I would ask them is, what are they going to use it for? And if it's just basic browsing and maybe an occasional Android app, geez, some of the new Acers, like the 514, $250, something in that range. I mean, they're almost all the same, Matthew, at that price point in terms of the specs. It comes down to like which one might have a better keyboard for you, you know, that you like, or something to that effect. There's just so many low end choices, and really, they're in a sense all the same, just minor differences at that point.
Right.
This is a big update, though, right? I mean, it's a not a point update.
Correct. This is a full release. We were all on 72 point something up to this point. And in fact, my Pixel Slate is still on 72. I did not get it yet. And again, I'll share on how you can find out if your device has it and when it's available. All of the major releases are big updates. Again, it gets back to they don't really tell you what's in them. And I think that's a very, very bad choice from a user experience, because we've got the bullet list that we had on the screen before, and those are great bits. But I've been tracking all the other things, and they didn't mention them there. And I mean, I probably found 6-7 large features that are very impactful.
Well, run through.
Why wouldn't they mention them?
You know,
I don't understand.
I think it's more of a cultural thing with release notes than anything else, Matt. I don't think it's to diminish any of the features. I think it's, you know, some of them are tied directly to bugs. So they know that a lot of people, right, you know, want to, for example, be able to map Google Drive in Linux, for example. Mm. And maybe not a lot of people do, but whatever. There was a lot of folks following that bug.
I do.
You can see all, there you go.
Yeah.
You can see all the open bugs and you can star them. And I have a feeling the more stars something gets, which gets you on an email list for the updates of that particular bug, probably has a lot to do with what they highlight and what they don't.
Got it.
There is one bullet point that has concerned some people, and it's this one. Report additional telemetry data for Chrome OS devices.
Hmm. Well, okay. And I understand that. I guess I would say...
Sounds harmless.
What could possibly... But, well, yeah. I just point out that this is exactly the phrase Microsoft uses, and and Microsoft Windows gets a lot of heat for selling or sending data back to the home office. Microsoft will say, and I bet Google will say, we use that telemetry to make our products better, to know what's going wrong, to know what you use, how you're using it. Is that what this is?
That's exactly what it is. It's nothing, to my knowledge, that's nefarious or data that's being sold. It is, in fact, you can, well, you probably wouldn't. I go through the actual code commits, and you can see that they are generating data from some of these after they roll out beta bits and things. And they're like, let's see, is this actually fixing the problem or is it not? So they have lots of histogram type data that they generate and send back to the mothership. But to my knowledge, it's really all to make the product better and see that the work they're doing is actually doing what they want it to do.
Right. So what are the biggest features that you think people will be excited about? And especially any features that people don't know about that aren't listed on that very short bullet list.
Yeah. So, I mean, we talked earlier about the really bad animations, for example, on the Celeron Slate. And and actually, it wasn't smooth on any of the devices, but there are many transition animation fixes in this version. I have not been able to test them on stable because I don't have it yet, but I have been testing it in dev and beta, and I've seen an improvement. So that's always a plus. I know a lot of people bought this as a tablet, and I still kind of question that because it's really a Chromebook in a different form factor, but that's a whole other issue. Enterprises should be pretty happy because they're getting, and in fact, Google mentioned on the bullet point something about printer mapping and so on. And that's obviously big in enterprises where they still print, but they're also getting Christini. And the reason they couldn't have it before is because there was no enterprise policy built into the Chrome administration management. Mm. So they added the tool to manage that. And so that way, if you're in an enterprise and you have managed devices, they can actually be managed to have Christini or not. Maybe they don't want you using Linux for whatever reason. I don't know.
Right.
One of the other really nice ones that is more universal, the native PDF annotation support, which is fantastic because even if you don't have a device with a pen, if you have a touchscreen device, you could mark up a PDF, sign your name, et cetera. Didn't work for filling in fields when I tested it, but I know they're working on that. But I know a lot of people are like, yeah, I got this PDF and all I can do is print it or look at it. And that kind of sucks. So that's a nice fix. And
so you don't really need a third party PDF utility. I use Kami in Chrome as a extension for PDFs. Sounds like I don't need it on Chromebooks.
Well, I mean, you could still use it. There's plenty of great Android apps, for example, and right, extensions, like you said, Leo, that let you do that. They're not going away. But no, the PDF annotation is built in and native. And if it does enough of what you need to do, there's no need to, you know, junk up your hard drive with extra stuff. So
I tell you how you found out about this stuff. Just go to aboutchromebooks.com. Kevin is obsessive about this.
I've heard of that.
Everything you'd ever want to know. It's right there. Some more leaks about Google's new low-priced Pixel 3s, the Pixel 3a and 3a XL. They'll be available in iris color in addition to black and white. I'm not sure what iris is. Is that bluish? This is according to Wind Future, blue-violet color. We also think that pricing is going to be around $500 for the 64 gigabyte, Pixel 3a, and the XL a little bit higher. So it's about $200 to $300 less. Actually, it's $350 less than the big boys, although Google seems to be offering some discounts lately on the Pixel XL, 3 XL, and the 3. Previous rumors said the Pixel 3a and 3 XL would launch at Verizon in the spring, which we're in right now. So keep your eye peeled if you want a low-priced Pixel 3.
I would grab that $300 off that they're doing right now at Google.
That's right. I mean, and the Chromebooks are a deal too, right?
Oh, that's right. Through March 28th, the Pixel books are all $200 off. So $799 for the base model, which wasn't a Celeron or an M3. I mean, that was a Core i5 with 8 gig of RAM.
Nice. Mm. And $200 off Pixel 3 and 3 XL right now. Yeah, I mean, I'm very happy with my Pixel 3. I had a period of time when something weird was going on, and then it just got fixed by, you know, I don't know if it was an update or somehow. But I've been very happy. But I read, boy, do I read the people with speaker issues still and screen issues and all sorts of stuff. I don't know what the QC, usually you'd expect that after a phone's been out for 6 months, it's going to be a pretty consistent product. And that seems like it's getting less consistent, not more consistent. So I'm not sure. I've in the past recommended a Pixel 3, and I used it for a long time, but I'm not sure I would still recommend it, especially in light of these new Samsung S10s, which are really good. YouTube has decided not to do scripted series, or maybe it is doing scripted series. It's kind of hard to tell. They deny now that they're canning scripted series and plan to launch an ad-supported list of scripted series. The Bloomberg had said that YouTube had stopped accepting pitches. Google did confirm it plans a big focus on paid subscriptions by introducing an ad-supported slate that will include new and existing series in the coming weeks. This is according to TechCrunch. This is in addition to YouTube Premium. This is something new.
It feels like YouTube's trying to have it both ways. I mean, Bloomberg said it was basically bowing out of the kind of expensive scripted show race.
This was at the same time as Apple announced its, you know, Apple TV Plus.
Right. So not that they're not still going to do it. And then I guess too many people said, wait, what the hell? You're not going to keep doing scripted shows? So they had to say, yes, we are. But really,
but not,
they're not.
No.
Not the really expensive ones.
TechCrunch says that they are canceling two existing shows, which I haven't seen, called Origin and Overthinking with Kate and June. I haven't seen either of those.
I better see Karate Kid.
That is good.
That was good.
I liked it. And then maybe it was because of you. Somebody recommended on this show, and I watched it, and it was really good. It's a reboot of the original Karate Kid.
Okay.
And is Mr. Miyagi back in it?
Or is No. It actually takes place in present day.
It's the son of the Karate Kid. Ralph Machado's son.
A neighbor.
Kid. Okay.
Yeah. But
it is.
Did he move in with
the Karate Kid grown up versus?
Oh, the Karate Kid grown up is the new Mr. Miyagi.
Yes. And more importantly, his opponent in the first movie.
Oh, that's right.
Is the new Mr. Miyagi.
And the twist. Right. The twist
is he's the good guy.
Is that he's the good guy? The bad guy in the Karate Kid movie who got beat up at the end.
Is now the good guy.
Turns out we completely misunderstood him and his motivations, and he's the good guy.
Love it.
Did I confuse? I think I confused everybody.
I just have to watch it now.
Do you have to pay to see that? I thought that was just part of YouTube.
That is part of YouTube TV.
Oh, okay. So you have to pay for YouTube. Okay. My problem is I just get bills from Google and I pay them. So I think I subscribe to everything. I might be wrong. I don't know.
Hey, Matthew, when you send an invoice to Leo, can you add my name and address on it?
Yeah, sure.
I think I'm paying for TV.YouTube.com. I think I have YouTube Red, what used to be called YouTube Red. I don't know what color it is now. I think I have Google Music. I think I pay for it all. But now there'll be another thing to pay for. So just Google, just send me a bill, okay? Facebook. You know, when you start a sentence with Facebook, just finish the sentence for me, will you? Apologizes. And says it'll never do it again. In this case,
oh, is this the passwords?
Yes, it's this. Well, yeah, just take your pick of stories. This is from Krebs on Security. Fortunately, the hundreds of millions of user passwords Facebook stored in plain text for years were never visible, as far as they know, outside of Facebook. But any employee at Facebook, 20,000 of them, had access to these and could have downloaded them. Facebook said the investigation so far, actually, this is a source, a senior Facebook employee who's familiar with the matter, speaking to Krebs on Security on condition of anonymity, says that between 200 million and 600 million Facebook users may have had their account passwords stored in plain text and searchable by more than 20,000 Facebook employees. Plain text user passwords dating back to 2012. Logs showed some 2,000 engineers or developers made approximately 9 million internal queries for these passwords. Facebook apologizes and says it will never happen again. It's hard. You know, computers are hard. Math is hard.
I mean, it was only a couple hundred million.
It's not a big deal.
A small percentage of our user base.
Yeah, it's not like a billion or something.
And here's the good news. Facebook is banning white nationalism and white separatism.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting.
They'll be treated the same as white supremacy. For a while, Facebook said, no, that's just nationalism. It's just separatism. Mm-hmm. Now they're saying, well, it kind of is like white supremacy. And they're going
to. I think they're trying to get out in front of potential legislation to show that they're being sort of proactive. Yeah. That's the way it feels to me.
We've been talking about Pwn to Own, the big Vancouver CanSec West security conference. Went on the last few days. Steve Gibson has a full report. But Firefox and Edge both bowed to hackers. So did a Tesla. So did Safari on Mojave. It's a bloodbath. But it's a good bloodbath because these exploits end up getting handed over to the company so they can fix them. And the hackers get a nice reward, although, as many have pointed out, not as much as they would have gotten paid by bad guys, companies that sell these exploits to nation states and things like that, like Zerodium. There was a escape from a virtual machine that would have been worth, I think, $500,000 on Zerodium. And the team Fluoroacetate that made the big bucks on Pwn to Own only got a fraction of that. Actually, they did all right. Over the 3 days, I think they earned something like $345,000. And the reason they call it Pwn to Own is when you pwn it, you own it. And one of the things they pwned was a Model 3 Tesla, which they drove off with their winnings in the trunk of. So that's good.
Free car.
Free car, man.
I just love that one of the exploits they used was involved the calculator and an integer underflow.
Well, I think that it didn't involve the calculator. The they call it popping calc.
Right.
Yes. The way you show victory is the least
to open the calculator.
Yeah, the least kind of evil thing you can do, which is have the calculator open up, and that shows yes, I own this machine, and all I'm going to do is launch the calculator. So popping calc is like crossing the finish line.
Got it.
Now, there's a big furor going on. We spent some time talking about this on Security Now yesterday as well, with Asus and Asus computers. And it's not clear exactly what happened. So I'll just give you the facts. This was discovered by the Russian cybersecurity firm Kaspersky Lab. And they said, we saw this with our customers, so it may be a mere fraction of the total infected computers. But our customers got malware on their computers pushed to their computers by the Asus software update tool. And the software was signed with a legitimate ASUS digital certificate. It what's weird, though, and I think very telling, is that the way the malware worked is it would only activate on about 600 systems, and it did that by MAC address. So the malware would get on your system. So in other words, I mean, while this is not a good thing, and ASUS has pushed out fixes, and if you have an ASUS laptop, you should be aware of it, but it probably didn't infect you because, or affect you. It did infect you, but it didn't affect you because only 600 systems had the right MAC addresses, and the malware searched for those, and once on the system, it would reach out to a command and control server and then install additional malware on the machine.
But that's actually more disturbing. How did they get those MAC addresses?
Well,
the ones they targeted.
Yeah. So that's what Steve and I spent some time talking about. And I'll give you my scenario, which Steve said that very possible. In fact, I think ASUS now says it was what we call an advanced persistent threat. When a bad guy gets into your network, like they did with Sony Pictures Entertainment, often they spend months there just browsing around looking for assets, figuring out what's going on. And one scenario would be, let's say a nation state. Let's say North Korea or Saudi Arabia or Israel or the NSA had penetrated this. Maybe they knew that an adversary's embassy had just taken order of 600 ASUS laptops. And they knew the range because they'd been browsing around in the ASUS customer records. That would be a perfect opportunity for them to put make a modified payload so that ASUS wouldn't know that this update payload had been modified, would sign it with their certificate and push it out, and then it would go look for those particular computers and then put spyware on there. So,
which means they were in ASUS's systems for a good long time.
Yeah, and I think that is, since the Security Now show, I think that ASUS has said that it was an advanced persistent threat, and that kind of confirms that scenario. Yeah, nobody wants to admit that, and that's the other reason that ASUS took a while to confirm it. It is bad, and I bet you it happens all the time, because these nation states are really good at
laying low.
Well, but doing spear phishing attacks, right? It's one thing to kind of put out a virus that affects a lot of people. Ransomware is, you want to cast a wide net. And while that's not hard to do, it's hard to predict the results of it. But if you're a hacker working for a government, you know what you want. Let's say you want the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C., and you're Saudi Arabia, and you get some intelligence that said, well, they just bought 600 new ASUS computers. It isn't so far-fetched to think that you would then say, oh, good, let's go get into the ASUS network, find those computers, and put something bad on them.
Target them.
So ASUS had been targeted by advanced persistent threat attacks, according to their press release. And that's typically government hackers or rarely highly organized criminal groups. A small number of devices, according to ASUS, have been implanted with malicious code through a sophisticated attack on our live update servers in an attempt to target a very small and specific user group. ASUS customer service has been reaching out to affected users and providing assistance to ensure that the security risks are removed. They also put out an update to prevent this. Kaspersky dubbed the malware Shadow Hammer because you got to have a good name. We know that. Yeah. And they said that 57,000 of their customers had it. I think that Motherboard then went to Symantec, which confirmed that they had seen it on their customers' computers as well. So anyway, just an update on that. And the latest, go ahead.
I kind of wonder, and maybe I shouldn't be worried about this, but we never hear about like the attacks or hacks on the supply chain when these things are being built. That either means there aren't any, or we just don't hear them.
No.
So I'm trying to think there was one
report about, I'm trying to remember if it was the FBI. They were grabbing products, routers, I think, in transit to customers and diverting them and then installing
Yeah, and Snowden, one of the Snowden leaks showed that there was a supply chain intact by the CIA, or was the, or maybe it was the NSA. I think it was the NSA that involved modifying Ethernet adapters in in computers in transit. So you do it in transit. You don't do it at the manufacturer. You do, you know, you get the mail truck. You
detour the truck.
You detour it, and you make those changes. I think they're hard to detect. It's one of the reasons you don't hear about it. A good supply chain attack is probably very hard to detect.
Well, and the guy, the this guy from the Center for Internet Security, who was a NSA analyst, said supply chain attacks are in the, quote, big deal category.
Yeah.
And are a sign of someone who really knows what they're doing.
Yeah. We're going to, I'm convinced we'll hear a lot more of these kinds of attacks, that they're not really something individuals have to worry about. But companies do.
Unless you're targeted.
A Democratic National Committee should. You know, this is something that if you're a target, exactly, you do have to worry about. And I think it's going to happen more and more. And I think it's going to be part of a kind of a background cold war, a cold cyber war that will be with us for many decades, maybe forever.
I think that's why that Bloomberg story got so much attention.
The super one micro story,
They haven't been able to sort of confirm, but right on a motherboard, tiny chip.
Let's do the Google changelog.
The Google changelog.
These are new things Google is adding to make your life better than ever. And Google is now amping email. And I have no idea.
Sounds great.
So AMP is that technology that they do for news organizations to make web pages load faster. Actually, it could be any web page. My website pages are AMP because there's a WordPress.com plugin. I just click the switch, and it means it loads faster. Google, despite their denials, I think it improves the search results. You know, AMP stuff shows up in an AMP carousel and all that stuff. AMP for emails coming to Gmail. But other major email providers like Yahoo Mail, Outlook, and Mail.ru, the Russian email provider, will also support AMP emails. It'll turn basic messages, oh boy, this sounds so dangerous, into a surface for actually getting things done.
Including hacking you and your computer.
Oh my God. Well, the good news is the JavaScript here has to all come from Google's servers, has to be approved JavaScript.
It sounds like interactive email, right? You'll
basically, it's amped websites in your email, right? Booking.com is going to use it. Doodle, Equid, Freshworks, Next, Oyo Rooms, Pinterest, and Redbus. I have no idea. And Despegar. If you build AMP websites, it should be a simple thing to do. It's standard HTML markup. And that's, by the way, the one reason that I haven't completely, you know, deprecated AMP, and I don't like it, but it's why I put up with it, because it does degrade to regular HTML. So you don't have to use an AMP browser, and you don't have to support it. So your email will continue to work. In other words, it just won't be as pretty. It's kind of like HTML email. It'll continue to work. It just won't be as pretty. Apple Music is on Chromebooks, you'll be happy to know. But probably not in the most bestest way, because it's coming through the Android app.
That's okay.
That's better than nothing, right?
Hey, it works for me. I don't know.
Yeah. Apple supporting Apple Music on Chromebooks, and that's just part of an Android update that's coming out. So if you want Apple Music on your Chromebook, you can now install the Android version of it. If you used If This Then That with Gmail, sad to say, they're turning off almost all, actually Google is turning off almost all If This Then That support. All you'll be able to do is send an email or send yourself an email. All the other If This Then That triggers are gone, which is a shame, because I think a lot of people use this as a way to, you know, I mean, you could think of a lot of ways you might want to use email to notify yourself, or
you could have custom things happen in your house based on email subject headers and things.
Yeah.
And,
right.
That's actually part of I think Twitter and Facebook have both shut off things that used to work with If This Then That.
It's a shame.
Which removed a huge amount of functionality. Like, I used to use it to do all sorts of things.
I think it's, you know, the excuse Google gives is security. It's part of tightening up Gmail's policies concerning third-party services.
Which is great, but the reality is it prevents you from doing things that are actually useful.
Yeah. If this then that said, they've tried to find a way to become compliant with the new policies, but that it couldn't do so without major infrastructure changes, which apparently they're unable to do or afford. We've long had a good relationship with Google, if this then that writes, and we support their efforts to improve privacy and security, though we understand this change may be a disappointment to the communities that use these applets. We look forward to working with Google in the future to blah, 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 blah. That's too bad. I use if this then that a lot. I also use something called Zapier, which is a paid version of this, if this then that. But I presume if this then that can't do it, Zapier won't be able to do it either. Google Podcasts, finally, adding, this is, it was really a stripped down podcast app, but I think this could make it the podcast app of choice. They're going to add in-episode search, which means you, without doing anything, and we, I should add, because you know what? We do podcasts too. We'll automatically have transcripts, and that those transcripts, probably computer-generated, but, you know, Google's good at that. They're not terrible. Will be searchable, which will make a big difference. You'd be able to, in theory, in Google Podcasts, search for Leo talking about Google Podcasts and jump right to this part of the show. I hope that happens. Apparently, people are finding
it in the EU thanks to Article 11 or 17.
Yeah.
Not available in the EU.
And Google Podcasts is great unless you want to listen to the BBC.
Yeah. Did you see that? The BBC has pulled its podcast from Google. They say they don't get enough information from Google.
Yeah, but what it feels like to me, and I've only followed this sort of tangentially, but what it looks like to me is BBC wants you to use the BBC's podcast app and not Google's podcast app.
Yes.
And so they're hoping that if you like the BBC, you'll go to their podcast app. And if you could just get the BBC in Google's app, then why would you use the BBC's?
In fact, BBC's been removing podcasts from other third-party platforms, too. The license that they've asked Google to sign requires Google to supply user data to the BBC. And since Google will not do that, this is going to happen, and I'm sad, and we will never bow to this. We certainly haven't done that. Because I support Google not sharing information with us. But I have a feeling that what's going to happen is advertisers want the same kind of data from podcasts that they already get from other digital media. You know, the Facebook kind of data, all the information about the ads, who are seeing the ads, that kind of thing. We as podcasters don't offer that, but it's just going to be a matter of time before. Well, you see it with Spotify and Spotify's acquisitions.
Yeah.
Spotify. If it's an exclusive.
They seem to be really trying to lock down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If it's an exclusive podcast that you can only hear on Spotify, dollars to donuts, the Spotify app is sending information about you and what you're listening to, how long you listened, where you stopped listening, is logging all that and sending it back to Spotify. And the reason they do that is because advertisers want that information. Advertisers always ask us, well, how do you know that people listen to the whole show? I mean, they don't ask a newspaper, how do you know people read the whole newspaper? They don't ask
The thing that struck me about the BBC thing is the BBC, it's a public entity. It's not a private corporation. Yeah. It's supposed to distribute its content as widely as
possible.
You
would think.
But it's effectively saying, no, you can't have it unless you use our app.
Yeah. And you get ready, because that's going to happen more and more. And it's a bad thing for podcasting, and it's a bad thing for you as listeners. And you have my promise that we won't do that. You'll never hear us say, "Oh, this podcast is available on Apple's iTunes only." That's or whatever. That's not going to happen. It's not in our interest. We want our podcast to be heard everywhere. We have an advantage, I have to say, because we're so narrow in our niche that we have plenty of advertisers. Because they, they know who you are. You're geeks. You're tech enthusiasts. So it's not, you know, that's enough for advertisers. And we do that survey once a year to find out how many men, how many women, you know, how much education, average income. It's completely voluntary. We don't do any other data collection. But so far, that's been sufficient for the advertisers for our shows. But I can see a day coming where people won't buy a podcast ad like that, like they buy regular media. They'll buy it like they buy Facebook ads. We want 25 to 54-year-old men who live in Northern California. Can you give us that? No, we can't.
Sure.
You can't. Can't do it. There's another way around it, which is insertion advertising. And we've toyed with that. It's not our model, because as you know, our model is
personal,
like endorsements from the host. And if you trust the host, then you'll trust the ad.
And I mean, a lot of insertion ads are terrible, right?
Yeah, insertion is kind of what you get now with TV and radio. And but the way podcast insertion would work, you would have to, again, use a particular player to listen to the show. Or you would, actually, the way it would work, you could use your regular podcast player, but it would announce your location to the download source. And as you're downloading the podcast, the host would insert ads in based on your location.
So dynamic.
Yeah, it's dynamic insertion. Mm-hmm. And there are companies that do this now. And we've actually, we took a few podcasts that didn't get advertising and see how that worked. We had some issues with it and we stopped doing it. That's not tracking you. Well, it is, because, of course, any podcast, anytime you download a podcast, our servers know your IP address. Mm-hmm. But that's all we know. We don't use that, but you could see how it could be used by somebody who wanted to insert ads. I don't know. We don't do that. I can't say we would never do that, but I'm a big believer, and I know, mostly because I know our audience is, in not collecting information about you.
I remember you and I talked about that NPR
Podcast
standard
Republic
they came up with.
Yeah, and they have their own app, right? And almost certainly that's part of the reason they bought an app. They bought Pocket Casts. Why? Well, because I bet you anything they'd like to put that kind of tracking in it. And we see a lot of pressure. There's a group called the IAB, the Interactive Advertising Bureau, that is really a lobbying group for advertisers who buy digital. They pretend to be listening to podcasters, but I think the IAB really is about advertisers. And really what they are is a pressure group, in my opinion, to pressure podcasts to adhere to advertisers' needs. I'm just glad that I'm close to retirement. I can hold on for 10 more years, but after that, I can't.
There's your show title.
That's right. Thank God I'm close to retirement.
Some new features in Google Maps as we continue the changelog. I don't know. I got drifted off topic. Speed limits. And if you have an electric vehicle, also chargers on your map.
Yeah.
So you'll know, and easy to see business hours. I always like that. So I know when they're open. And Google Maps does something that, remember, that was a little controversial when Swarm did it. Their parent company did it at South by Southwest. Google Maps will tell you when it's busy at a place.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Foursquare had that thing they only did for South by this year, where it would say, oh, there's a lot of people at that bar right now. Yeah. I thought it was a little creepy because they know a lot about where people are.
Handy information.
Yeah, but it is handy if you want to go when it's less busy. And that Google Maps also has that information on there, which is nice.
That speed limit bit, I didn't realize it was so new. I drove 1,100 miles in 2 days last week to Dayton, Ohio to see my Sun Devils play in the first four basketball game. And I saw speed limits almost the entire way on Google Maps.
Nice.
Yeah, I don't get out of the house much, so I didn't know that was a new thing.
Wow. It's apparently a new thing. I've never seen it before. Yeah, I like it. Yeah, it's great if it just shows up there, especially if you have Android Auto and it's showing up clearly on a visible screen. That's very handy. Because, I mean, otherwise, you got to make sure you look for the signs.
Yep.
I think that is the Google changelog. And I think that's pretty much our show. I would love to get, if you wish, a pick of the week from you, Kevin Toefel.
So I promised two. One is for everyone, so I'll do that one first. I have a link in the show notes to show you, and this is great to bookmark if you're a Chrome OS user, by the way, which version of Chrome OS is available for your individual device.
Oh.
Well, just by the name of the device, not by you personally, but you know what I mean. So on the right-hand side, they list all the device names. On the left-hand side, they have the device boards. If true geeks know what their board is, it's Nocturne for the Pixel Slate, for example.
Wow. I guess okay. I'm not a geek.
I'm great at parties, too. So you can see in the blue that some of these guys have the new Chrome OS 73 already. So there's your Acer Chromebook 15, for example, that has it, whereas the Chromebook Flip 101 does not. So you can always see what's there. And I believe those recovery links you can actually download and kind of roll back if you needed to, but I don't think anybody really needs to do that. So, but yeah, so bookmark that if you're a Chromebook user and you can see when something is released, what version it is, and when it's available for your device.
Do you, at parties, do people come up to you with their Chromebook and say, hey, Kevin, what model is this?
Can you take a look at this?
Could you, yeah. What is this Nocturne? What is the motherboard on this?
Yeah, I can actually do that. Sometimes with my eyes closed, if they tell me the name of the device or I can feel it. Yeah. It's one of the things my wife carries me, takes me around the neighborhood and says, here, he can figure out your Chromebook in 10
do
minutes.
Tech support.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's like when you're a doctor. Yeah. I got a pain right here.
How about a non-geeky just for Leo pick? Although if anybody else enjoys this, I would, that'd be great.
Is it a Beatles pick?
Of course it is.
I believe it is.
I'm happy now. The Daily Beatles Instagram account.
If you're not, even if you're not on Instagram, you know, you don't have to sign in to see this. The videos and photos of some of these things are phenomenal, things I've never seen before.
Oh, this is really cool.
Yeah, click it. It's awesome.
There's John and is that Mick Jagger?
Yeah.
My mother was of the sky. My father was of the earth.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
What?
See, you're so wacky.
And then a little Mick. Yeah. What is this? Is this from? What?
I don't know. I think this is something that's being restored.
Beatles did a lot of stuff with fan clubs.
Yeah.
They used to send out that Christmas record every year and stuff like that. I don't know if that's what this is.
Or, I don't know. I'm still waiting for my Christmas album. I never got one.
It's the Rolling Stones Circus.
Oh, that's what it is. But, I mean, for people who like their music, it's great. And for people who just think they were just rock and roll stars and don't know how wacky funny these guys were, some of these interviews are absolutely hysterical.
All right. Well, I got something for you if that's what you want.
Music.
Oh, yeah. The press conferences were great.
This is fun. As being about a prostitute and Norwegian Wood about... as being about a lesbian. Now, I just wanted to know what your intent was.
The press hasn't changed much, have they?
What your feeling is about the Time magazine criticism of the music that is being written today.
Well, you're just trying to write songs about prostitutes and lesbians, that's it.
Love you, Paul! Love you! Love you! Love you!
Yeah, so that's something I visit almost all the time. It can be a huge time suck, really.
So I'm really curious... if you've seen this, this is the Danny Boyle movie coming soon.
Oh, right.
Called Yesterday.
I am dying to see this.
Became the biggest star in the world.
First of all, because Kate McKinnon's in it, and I'll go see anything she's in. The premise of it is something's happened to the timeline of the world, and this guy is suddenly alive in an era that had no Beatles. They never happened. But he knows all the Beatles' music. So when he sits down with a guitar and plays Yesterday, everybody says, wow, that's really good. Did you write that? No, the Beatles did. Who?
When did you write that?
I didn't write it. Paul McCartney wrote it. The Beatles.
Who?
All of a sudden, he's a superstar. Playing Beatles music.
Yep.
I think this is a great premise for a movie. Yeah. Plus a chance to get some great music.
Well, it's not Coldplay. It's not Fix You.
It's not Coldplay.
It's not Fixing. In times of trouble,
Mother Mary. My favorite part is in the recording studio, they say, I think you should call that Hey Dude. Hey Dude.
Ed Sheeran who says that.
Is it Ed Sheeran?
That's awesome.
Pretty sure.
Oh my God.
That's something I didn't say.
It's incredible. We need you to come to LA. I'm offering you money and fame.
And of course, Kate McKinnon is the evil music executive. There's Ed Sheeran.
Oh, really?
No, I'm only kidding. No, leave it to the brothers. That'd be my advice. Hey,
Jude. You're leaving, so I can ask you anything. How did I get in the friend column instead of the and I love her column?
Doesn't matter, we're a superstar.
At one point, he's on one of those late night TV shows, and the guy says, well, write a song for us right now. And what does he write? He writes George Harrison's Something in the Way She Moves. And they're all like, you're amazing.
It's a great premise. And of course, being Beatles, I will be there on day one. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I really think that's a great idea. Danny Boyle is one of my favorite directors, except for the Steve Jobs movie. But in every other respect, a really great director who is... This is perfect material for him. Matthew Ingram, how about you? Have anything you'd like to tell us?
So I sort of stole this from the lineup.
Good, because we didn't get to it, right?
The Motion Picture Association of America said that that basically digital home entertainment or digital entertainment has now surpassed cable.
Wow.
So streaming video, I think they said 613 million subscriptions worldwide, up 27%.
Wow.
Cable subscriptions are at 556 million. So the interesting thing is cable still makes orders of magnitude more money than streaming.
Right, because most of the streaming is either free or you know, one flat fee.
But you think about the number of people that are signed up, the amount of time spent, the amount of content consumed, that gap has got to shrink, right? Cable's got to lose and digital's got to win. I mean, we're talking $118 billion for cable, I think.
Yeah. Wow. This is the kind of disruption I enjoy. You can stick it to Comcast. It's okay. It's okay.
It reminds me of those great slides from... Who's the veteran Silicon Valley?
Mary Meeker?
Yeah, Mary Meeker. Yeah, so every year she would have a slide showing time spent on mobile.
Yeah.
And then, you know, time spent with print. And then the amount of money spent. And it was always hugely out of whack. But you knew over time those things were going to, you know, get closer
together.
Or
maybe not. I mean, in a way, that's kind of part of the problem we've got, which is that people are moving to non-monetizable content or content that has... no perceived value.
Right. Or where it's more difficult to monetize.
Yeah. Or and it's becoming commoditized. So then what happens, right?
If you think about the early days of cable, they couldn't figure out how to monetize it either.
Right.
They just got like Jack Benny to hold a pack of cigarettes or something and say, hey, smoke Lucky Strikes, you know, and they hope that people would smoke Lucky Strikes.
A lot of people smoke Lucky Strikes.
And then eventually they figured it out.
Little pick from me, just something to zone out and relax with. Actually, I've got two picks. One is our sponsor, Calm.com. Moby just announced his new album is available only on Calm.com, which is wild. I think the first time I can remember anybody only shipping, you know, an album on a premium web service. I guess this kind of speaks a little bit to what you were talking about with the move towards content streaming. So that's one. But if you don't want to pay Calm.com for your Moby music, here it is, Long Ambience 2, exclusive album only on Calm. It's I'll play a little bit just so you can hear that. I love Moby. I'm a Moby fan. There's only, I think, 6 or 7 cuts, but they're long. This one's 47 minutes. It's kind of for meditating. Yeah. But if you don't want to pay for Moby, this is generative.fm.
Just nodded off there.
Sorry. Wake up. This is a really wild site where these are music, musical styles, and then generative music around that style. So it's a collection of music pieces that are created in real time by a computer. It's created by Alex Bainter. And I'll give you, there's a lot of different styles. So this is didgeridoo beats, and it's infinite. So it'll keep playing. I think you hear the didgeridoo there.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But maybe didgeridoo isn't what you want. So there's different types of sounds. This is drones. Maybe you want something a little lighter. Here's Spring Again.
That's amazing. And these are all computer generated.
Completely in real time computer generated.
Wow.
And actually pretty good.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, this is be good for meditation, good for relaxation. A lot of people like to play kind of this kind of music in the background while they code or write to kind of relax and tune out. Audible sounds from the world around us, ambient noise.
I do that every day, 8 hours a day.
Yeah. So you might want to
Spotify, but now I'll take a look at this.
Yeah. Because if I listen to real music, I get involved in the music, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Generative.fm.
Generative. Love it.
I mean, this could be Chopin. This could be Debussy. But it's really ENIAC.
Wow.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have come to the conclusion of this thrilling, gripping edition of This Week in Google. Thanks in no small part to the genius of Matthew Ingram, chief digital writer at CJR.org. Off to Perugia with his boxing gloves and his notepad. When do you leave?
Yeah, I'm not going to take the gloves, I don't think.
Oh, good. What is Perugia? What goes on there?
So it's a beautiful hill town in Umbria. Used to be a big deal in like the year 300 or so. It was the capital of the Etruscan Empire.
Nobody heard of the Beatles there either.
But now it's got a university. It's known for its chocolate, and it has, I think, a jazz festival, and it has this journalism festival.
So what is a journalism festival?
I think they called it a festival just to make it sound more interesting.
Do journalists come up on stage and read some of their best
conference?
Works? Or
not usually, no. But I think the idea was this is going to be better than just a regular conference. And it's a spectacular event. I've gotten to know the founders, and it's 5 days. And there's, I think, something like 300 or 400 speakers. There's 15 different venues. And the whole thing is free. It's all sponsored. They live translate sessions into English and Italian. It's all held in the old city. Well, the medium old city. So
I've seen your pictures old city, each year.
Yeah. So the old city where it's held is things are from around 1100, 1200, and then that's built on the ruins of this ancient Etruscan city from the year 300 and whatever. It's amazing.
There's also a very famous language school in Perugia. My sister went there to study Italian.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, it's
I didn't know that.
Really beautiful. Beautiful.
It's a beautiful, beautiful
that
city.
Not,
and
Machu Picchu,
lovely.
Not the Perugia, but okay. Yeah. Apparently somebody made a mistake. There was a hashtag error on this. Yeah, they put Peru and Perugia. There's your mistake.
Peru. Got it.
Peru is not Perugia. Okay, I'm just saying. Yeah, the show also sings thanks to Mr. About Chromebooks.com, Kevin Toefel. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And his lovely dog, Norman. Kevin, anything you want to plug?
No,
I know. There's a little podcast you do with somebody named Stacey Higginbotham.
I've heard of that.
Correct. Yes. We did it this morning, and she did it from Finland, I think, this morning. And
Finland.
Yeah, so IoT podcast spelled just like it's sounds just like it's spelled IoTpodcast.com.
What's she doing in Finland?
I'm under NDA. I can't. No,
she's
meeting folks and speaking. Yeah. Yes,
I think it's Finland, and then she said Norway too, or somewhere else.
There's wow, great! Yeah. Good for her.
Nice trip, right?
Yeah,
nice.
Yep.
All right. Thank you, fellas, for filling in for our missing hosts. But, hey, it's fun. I like it. Come back anytime.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah. We do This Week in Google Wednesdays, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. If you want to watch live or listen live, you can go to twit.tv/live. That's our live page. Pick your stream. If you're doing that, you really probably should also be in the chat room. That's where everybody else watching and listening live is. That's irc.twit.tv, friendly place that you'll be more than welcome to join. You can also do it on demand. Just, you know, go to twit.tv/twig and download episodes from there, audio or video. You know, my favorite thing would be if you'd subscribe. And just pick your favorite podcast application. We're on every one of them. That's one of the beauties of this. And subscribe to This Week in Google. That way you'll see it or hear it every single week the minute it's done. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next week on This Week in Google. Bye-bye.